Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Werkraut.
And today we have a really special episode. We are remembering one of Hollywood's greatest actors and icons, who we lost too soon. We are remembering James Dean. 70 years after his death, he had two huge films come out in 1955. We will be talking about both of those today, East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat about both of these movies today and James Dean, his unfortunately short-lived career, but is still known as one of Hollywood's greatest actors. And we only had three movies from him. So that, I don't know, in going into these movies that we watch today, knowing that, I think that made me think about these performances differently than any actor or movie I think we've covered on the pod. These are 70-year anniversaries, like you said. So I don't know, it was a different time, and I think that's very apparent in these films, and that's what makes it hard, I think, for some people today in understanding them or enjoying them, critiquing them. But his performances are undeniable, and I think it's just his charisma and looks, truly. Like, you watch these movies and you just can't not be awed by his beauty. So we'll definitely talk about his career and how we think about these films, some of their inspirations or what they've inspired since. I think that's interesting. But yeah, I will just say off the bat that this is the first time I've seen a James Dean film. I've Wow. never seen these before. Mm-hmm. I didn't know in La La Land that the car driving up to the planetarium, that was the scene from Rebel. I have always put this off. I mean, it's for a reason. I always wanted to read East of Eden first. Obviously, John Steinbeck. We've talked about The Grapes of Wrath before, so I never got to it. But I think covering this film and its differences from the book, I don't know if you've read that or not, but we can talk about that. And I think how that compares to, I feel like these are also intro to film class films or something you would watch in school in terms of covering East of Eden or religion or the book itself. Had you seen these before?
Yeah, I had seen these before, but it had been a really long time. And I think what's so interesting about James Dean is that he only made three films, like you said, throughout his career. It was incredibly short-lived. He passed away tragically in a car accident at 24. And I think in my head, I thought he was part of the 27 Club and died a few years later. But to be 24 and to just have, I think, this type of output, only three films, but these performances just speak to a type of electricity within his work. And I think you're right. It is also partly because of his looks and how beautiful he is. But I think he also just came to symbolize and represent the era. I think you can't think of the 50s and even the 60s without thinking about James Dean and the type of behavior I think that he inspired and influenced within teenagers at the time. I tend to view him in pairs with two other celebrities. So I think of him alongside Elvis as representative of this specific type of American iconography at the time, this rebellious nature, but also I think of him alongside Marilyn Monroe. When you go to Hollywood Boulevard, or when you think about film stars of this time, I think those are two of the biggest names, and I think that the tragedy is a big part of that. You know, how they died, how their lives ended way too soon, and how it was just like this bright torch being snuffed out. I think that is also why people are fascinated with them and with their careers. So it's a big part of it. But I think with James Dean, what's so interesting about the two movies that we'll talk about today, alongside Giant, which I actually watched recently too. I was on a long haul flight, and that's when I tend to watch some epics because I just have uninterrupted time, you know, that came out also posthumously like Rebel Without a Cause did. But Giant and East of Eden are these two large-scale Hollywood epics. East of Eden is shorter in the runtime front than Giant is, but they're dealing with these large-scale issues. They're thinking about these grand themes of identity in America and capitalism. And we'll get into some of those when we cover Giant eventually, but they're prestige pictures. And Rebel Without a Cause is not that. Rebel Without a Cause is this teen movie that I think spawns a slew of movies that weren't exactly taken seriously. So I like that we're talking about both of these today, because I think that the goal of East of Eden was to adapt John Steinbeck's great work. I have read the book. I love the book. So I'm excited to talk about that and the differences. But then Rebel Without a Cause, that I don't think had any intentions of being what it was. But I think because of James Dean's performance and the ideas that it's talking about and that feeling that it captured, and the connection, I think, to James Dean's real life really turned it into this classic that's still talked about today. So it's going to be a really interesting discussion and conversation. I'm so glad we're talking about him, because when I watch these movies for this episode in particular, I couldn't help but just think the hype is real. Like, this man is loved and adored, and it is completely warranted. In the same way that I felt when we talked about Psycho and Anthony Perkins' performance in that, and how I think you don't get Andrew Garfield without Anthony Perkins in Psycho. Any Timothée Chalamet fans listening today, his father, not his real father, but you know, the grandfather or the father of Timothée Chalamet is right here. It's James Dean in East of Eden. You don't get anything that Chalamet is doing today, I think, without what Dean is doing here. So let's get into it. I think there's some good stuff here.
Yeah, I think these two movies also, again, we only have three from him, but there are a lot of differences. There are comparisons, I would say, in character, and watching these together in the same week probably wasn't the best idea. I'm still trying to differentiate scenes between the films because there are certain dynamics that parallel in both films. And you can distinguish those differences through James Dean's acting. I think another iconic actor that people had compared him to back in the day, but also is undeniable in terms of his acting, is Marlon Brando, fellow method actor. But there is something so singular here. And again, looking at what critics said, many people called his acting histrionic. And I think that's interesting, looking at the melodrama genre as a whole. And I think that has to do a little bit with, I mean, that was at the time, but also looking back 70 years at how different acting is, movies are, Hollywood has become. And I think that's another topic for us to talk about today. So yeah, getting right into James Dean, a little bit more about his background, because East of Eden was his first leading role in a film, which is crazy because his first gig was in a Pepsi commercial, and then he had some smaller roles in TV and film before being discovered on Broadway, playing in The Immoralist. And then after that, there was only a year and a half span where he shot those three films, East of Eden, Rebel Without a Cause, and Giant, before he passed tragically in a car crash. Only East of Eden was released while he was alive. So again, those posthumous awards that you mentioned, and we'll talk about briefly in a second, came from those following two films. So his awards in general, he was nominated for two Oscars in lead actor for East of Eden and Giant. At the BAFTAs, he had two nominations for best foreign actor for East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause. And then at the Golden Globes, he posthumously won a Special Achievement Award for Best Dramatic Actor for East of Eden, and the Henrietta Award, which was only given from 1950 to 1979 to recognize the most popular male and female film stars, that was awarded to him in 1956.
Really quickly, have you seen Giant before?
No, it was, I think, at Film Forum last year. I did forego that experience because of where I was in my life, I'll say, and that long runtime. Will I get to it? Yes. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if we're watching two out of three of his films, also you can't just not watch Giant despite the epic it may be or its difficulty. I don't know how beloved that film is either, though.
I wouldn't call it beloved, but I thought there was a lot of interesting stuff going on in it. And specifically James Dean's performance is why I would recommend watching it, because I always thought that the Daniel Day-Lewis performance in There Will Be Blood felt reminiscent of John Huston's work, but it actually, for me, had a lot of comparisons to what James Dean is doing in Giant and what that character experiences. So if you like There Will Be Blood and what Daniel Day-Lewis is doing there, I highly recommend watching Giant for James Dean, because there are a lot of interesting parallels between the two characters and the performances.
Okay.
But we can get into East of Eden. So description here, two brothers in 1910s California struggle to maintain the favor of their affectionate but strict Bible-toting father as an old secret about their long-absent mother comes to light. This is, of course, based on the novel by John Steinbeck and was directed by Elia Kazan. It stars James Dean, Joe Van Fleet, Raymond Massey, Julie Harris, and Burl Ives. This won one Oscar for Supporting Actress for Van Fleet and received three other nominations for Director, Lead Actor for Dean, and Adapted Screenplay for Paul Osborne. So you mentioned that you hadn't read the book yet, but I'm curious what you thought of the movie and specifically of James Dean, who plays Cal, one of the brothers.
I knew what the story was, that it's the retelling of Cain and Abel. I didn't know how that was going to come about. I hadn't heard much about this film or from Rebel Without a Cause, really. So I really did go into these only knowing about James Dean, and I would say very little at that. And I think I actually, again, getting ahead of myself and maybe making too drastic of a comparison, prefer James Dean here. I think there are more nuances in his relationships with his father, which I think are immediately apparent and things that audiences can relate to. His brother's girlfriend, Abra. But I like his performance here. I think from the opening shots, I would say we have a cinematographer, Ted McCord, at least partially to thank for some of this beauty, because of just some of his shots. There are a lot of canted angles and wide shots that are beautiful, either of the scenery or of using CinemaScope, these rich colors and these beautiful sets, the house, the carnival. He also shot The Sound of Music and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, I think two wonderful, beautiful films. But I would say his best moments are when he's at rest and we're just watching him either watch other people, or he's brooding, or we're trying to analyze what he's thinking about based on the trauma, his feelings, his pain that he's going through constantly throughout this film. I know you mentioned the opening shots of him, and I think both of them in these films are wonderful. I think I may favor the one in Rebel a little bit because it's in that opening sequence, but you can't not see him in that beige sweater here and think, just, who is this human? How is this possible?
I was trying to think of what it would have felt like to have been 16, like in the 50s, and what it would have felt like to see him for the first time on the big screen, because even now, me as a 31-year-old woman, I thought, what is going on? It felt like being struck by lightning watching it. You just think, who is this person? There isn't anyone working today who has this going for them. It's just not the same. And it's just that type of talent that comes around once in a blue moon, and he just had it. It's that kind of movie star quality that can't really be taught. I think you just have it. And I agree with you. I think his best moments as an actor in both films are really when he's sitting with his emotions, because I know that critics at the time, like you said too, called his acting histrionic or thought it was too much, but really it was so evolved, and I think it was where a lot of acting was heading. And it's also, I think, why I feel his performances in both of these movies kind of rise above the rest of the cast. And I think that's more of a problem for me in Rebel Without a Cause than it is in East of Eden, but we will get there. So with East of Eden, like I mentioned, I love this book. And what's strange about the movie and why I'm really excited for Zoe Kazan's miniseries is that the book is very long. It's a doorstopper. It's a long book. But the first three parts of the book are cut out. So you don't really learn any of that family history that you do in the book. It just takes you to this relationship between Cal and Aaron, these two brothers, and their relationship with their father, Adam, who clearly prefers the straight-laced, good-natured Aaron to Cal, the James Dean character. So I think that that's just such a unique choice. And while I think the film does suffer without some of the understanding of the key generational aspects in these repeated ideas and motifs that come up throughout the book and how history repeats itself for families, I think that the character really that suffers the most from this is the Kate character, their mother. When you read the book, you will find out so much about her and her really, really dark past. And the movie barely scratches the surface, I think, on that. But what I think is so interesting about James Dean in this movie is that his version of Cal, his interpretation of Cal, is very different than what you see in the book. In the book, Cal is very introverted. And I think we see that a bit here with James Dean's Cal. He's a bit of a loner. But I think at the same time, Cal's emotions are very expressive. And when we see him with Abra in particular, Aaron's girlfriend, we get to see a side of Cal that I don't think we see in the book. And instead of him being this introvert loner that Steinbeck created, he's someone who needs someone next to him. He's someone who needs and wants relationships. And that, to me, is a more interesting interpretation of the character. And the fact that he's doing this, I think it's also Kazan doing this, of course. But the fact that James Dean is interpreting the character this way and bringing this version of Cal to the forefront of the story is really wise for, again, someone so young and someone so inexperienced in film, really. And what he does here, I think, with this performance and this interpretation is that throughout the movie, his performance, I think, it builds in such a smart, emotional way. And you also come to really understand him and what he's going through. And he becomes the core of the film for me. I mean, he is East of Eden, the film. And I think when you read the book, you don't necessarily feel that way. There are more characters. There are, you know, it's this beautiful novel that really builds. But I don't think you necessarily come away from it thinking about the tragedy of the Cal character or the tragedy of the Cain character, if you will, in the Bible. But I think that is your takeaway when you're watching the movie. And that's why it is, for me, I think, James Dean's best performance of the three films that I've seen, and definitely of the two today. I think he's clearly known for his work in Rebel Without a Cause. But I think if you're looking for the performance of his career, I would go to East of Eden.
Mm-hmm. I agree. This movie really does rely on James Dean in this movie's success. I did have trouble with some aspects that you were describing in terms of its adaptation to a film. And yes, it's covering a third or a quarter of that book, but I think it is so black and white a little bit in its exposition of getting it done very quickly, which I appreciate. But I think in that really villainizes the mom without explanation. We kind of have this question of, oh, you shot him. And I'm like, what happened? So some of that is difficult. And like the good, bad brother is very clear between Aaron and Cal, and the dad loving Aaron because he's this really good kid. But as we watch the movie, we learn that it's really for the wrong reason that they are that way. And once we have the big climax with the fight and how the dad sees them and what happens between the brothers, I think that really shows us the core of what Steinbeck and I think Kazan are getting at. But I think just off the bat, are there any big differences with the plot of this section, like of the film, Like, is the plot with Abra, like, does that happen? Or are there any big changes that Kazan made to make this film its own thing apart from the book?
So what's interesting, I think, is that there are a lot of differences just in, first I'll say, in what they left out that I think is key, and then I think what's included and what's different. So what you were saying about Kate, the mother character, I think is so completely true. And while I do find the movie to be mostly successful, I think that having the additional context of that character in particular, like in the book, I don't want to entirely give it away for you what happens, but you have a very particular understanding, I think, of why you would interpret this character as an evil character based on her past actions with her family and how she actually came to be in a relationship with their father, who also had a complicated relationship with his brother. And the interesting part there is also that the father character, Adam, he and his brother Charles had a very similar relationship. Again, think of these names here, another AC pair. Very similar relationship that Aaron and Cal have. The other part of that, though, is that Adam was not the brother who was loved by his father. He was the Cal. So this idea that he's then repeating history, right, that he would never, you would theoretically never repeat that behavior to your child, especially if you were the one who was not loved as much by your father, but he's repeating that behavior and treating Cal that way. So I think that's a really interesting kernel that's in the book that's not included in the movie. The Abra storyline in the movie feels much more Hollywood. It's like the Ferris wheel scene in particular, and just their romance and flirtation. In the book, Cal starts a relationship with her after Aaron goes to war, and he's actually killed in World War I. So that's another, I think, big difference, where the movie feels a bit more Hollywood and the book feels more epic in that sense.
Okay.
If that makes sense. There are also characters that are cut, so there are some character differences from the book and the movie that I think the miniseries will definitely include, because there's just more time to go into it. But I think the problem with it that I agree with you is that you do kind of just feel plopped down into the world in a lot of ways, which I don't tend to have a problem with. Like, I like when you are just in media res and you're just there in the world with the characters. But I think that the success of the story ultimately does come down to the history that you know of these people and this family. So I think it would benefit from what the book does, which is it just goes into that history and in a much more in-depth way. But I also think that what Elia Kazan does here visually is really smart and very gripping. I think, you know, in telling the story of these two brothers in the way that he does with the camera alongside his DP that you mentioned, these canted angles, these wide shots, it feels so cinematic and important. And I was also thinking a lot about Elia Kazan's background as a stage director, his work in the theater, because so many of his establishing shots, I think, that are in rooms or in interior spaces with two characters or even just one character on their own, they feel like you're watching a theatrical production. And I mean that in a very positive way. I think it feels very character driven and focused. And then when you are outside and it does shift to feeling like more of this historical large scope story, you have the shots to really back that up. I mean, when you see Cal on top of that train with that sweater wrapped around him, it is gorgeous. It is a beautiful, beautiful shot that feels like this person who is caught between these two places. And that's what we learned in the opening scroll at the beginning with the overture. When we get the background, it's like, it's very obvious they're trying to create this binary between these two places, between the Salinas Valley and Monterey. And when he's on top of that train, you just feel him as this person who's between two places, who's trying to figure out his identity, who's trying to find his mother, who up until this point he thought was lost. And I think the way that Kazan tells the story visually is very smart and really beautiful. So while I think, you know, the film suffers because it decides not to go into the story as much as I would have liked it to, I think what it does tackle is done very well.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is because of Kazan, because he's able to focus on the small, the emotion with those close-ups and our great actors, but we also get those stunning wide shots on top of the train, even in interiors, in some of those final shots in the bedroom where he frames the characters so specifically that it just feels like they're miles apart and he's looking from the door to the bed. And it's just beautiful to see those. Or when he's swinging on the front porch talking to his dad and the camera slowly moves and shifts to keep him in frame. Some of those moments are just beautiful and they add to the conversations that they're having. But talking about James Dean's character and the similarities between these two films, we are made to believe that he's a troublemaker. And I don't think that's the case. I kept thinking of how that wasn't necessarily true, but it's almost like this is rebel with a cause and that one's rebel without a cause.
Because, wait, I love that. That's so funny.
Because he's just misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately saw what was happening inside his head, that he felt misunderstood. You know, his dad didn't like him no matter what he did. And we see that time and again throughout this film that, you know, even when he does become a new son in a way, he starts to work for his dad, help him with the icebox contraption or the transportation. His dad never fully appreciates him. He says, why did you steal that from the mine? Or at the very end with the money, he doesn't accept it because he thinks he stole it. And he was hardworking. He, yes, got that money from his mother. And that's another thing. I'm just really surprised that she gave him the money so easily, it seems. But he's not really a bad kid or person. I think he's been through some difficult experiences. But in the end, at that brawl, he ends up protecting the German neighbor and the house and fighting for him. So you know that he's coming from a good place. He has great intentions. And I think everyone else is just misunderstanding him, which is upsetting because that's the central focus of this story, of the family dysfunction in Rebel and the differences in his parents and grandma. And I think I very often have trouble with those kinds of plot devices, I'll say, which end up with a finale that either comes too quickly and too romantically to sum things up, where I just don't believe in it as much. I think that's my trouble with connecting and appreciating, I guess, both of these films.
Yeah, there are many connections I think that you can make between the two films. So we will definitely, I think, do that in a few minutes when we talk about Rebel Without a Cause. One thing I did want to point out, because I agree, Kate, his mom, giving him the money makes no sense to me. It never has. And I think it's because in the book, she doesn't give him the money. This character named Lee gives him the money. And Lee was completely cut out from the movie. So this is an extra character in the book who I think is one of the best characters in the book. And Lee is Adam's friend and housekeeper. And he raises Cal and Aaron effectively. Mm-hmm. But it would have, I think, to include him would have added quite a bit to the movie, runtime and plot wise. So that's a pretty significant difference. But I think I agree with you, like the scene where he's trying to please his father, he's trying to do the right thing, he just goes about it in his own way, and it's almost like he could never win in the first place with him. It's like he tries to mm-hmm. do all these things and he just can't get there, which I do think is why the final scene is so effective and is so dramatic and showcases, I think, some of James Dean's best work in the movie. But I would be curious, you know, what you thought of the book, but also watching this movie again just made me more intrigued about this miniseries that's coming.
I'll let you know in like 3 years when I finish the book.
It's a long one. It is. All of his books are long and dense. And now I'm just picturing you listening to the audiobook like Marion and Lady Bird of Grapes of Wrath.
Oh my gosh.
This has been Grapes of Wrath. It's the whole college tour.
AI James Dean voice doing audiobook.
Well, I just got this great copy of East of Eden, actually, the book, when I was in London. I usually don't like movie poster covers on books, but this had this really beautiful illustration of James Dean in character on the book cover, so I had to buy it. So it's sitting right back there on my bookshelf. So we can get into some of our questions. How do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think they would love it. This would be a Best Picture nominee, probably front runner in many categories, including acting. It could almost be like a big five. You know, we have lead actor, supporting actor, probably for Raymond Massey, for Adam, the father, James Dean. I don't know, even I wrote this outline before I saw the movies, but Joe Van Fleet winning for Kate seems absurd, not in a totally bad way, just so surprising for her role and the character and how different it is from the book. I know that doesn't play into any of it, but she's there, and potentially Abra, definitely up there for adapted screenplay like it was. It's an epic tale from the Bible. Like, I feel like that would just play well to many audiences and voters. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think this would do really well today. They love their historic epics. It's based on a classic novel. You know, it gives these actors the opportunities, I think, to, you know, tap into these very emotional scenes. And the Jovian Fleet win, actually, I do like. And I will tell you that I like it also because I do not like Natalie Wood's nomination for Rebel Without a Cause, just to spoil how I feel about that performance.
Wait.
Yeah. I don't know. That, to me, feels like such a supporting actress winning performance. Mm-hmm. Playing this, like, mysterious mother figure who comes into the fold, a well-known older actress at the time, too. That feels like something that would still happen. I'm imagining Leslie Manville or someone in the role and just winning.
I could totally see that, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that neither of these films were nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
That feels odd. And then Elia Kazan's up for director. But this is the year of Marty, which won both, including Best Actor. So it makes sense in a way. If you could give this movie one Oscar, would it be for James Dean?
It would be for James Dean. I would give him my Best Actor prize this year. I think that what he does with this character is brilliant and emotional, and it surprised me throughout, and I was pretty floored by this performance. I honestly couldn't believe it when I was watching it. I really just was so impressed by him, and feel like, again, like what I said earlier about this character of Cal, when I read the book, he wasn't the core of the story for me. But in the movie, it's undeniably his. So I would go with James Dean. What about you?
I would too. I think cinematography and direction are close seconds, but it's James Dean. Absolutely. I'm glad I watched this first. I mean, this was his first film. I'm curious, had I watched them in reverse, how I would have perceived both performances. But I think it's just emotion is overwhelming. Seeing him cry is devastating. And it just seems so effortless for him. From the minute we see him sitting on that curb, waiting to follow Kate to the end in the drama, it's a story you follow because of him. And I think when you come away from this movie, and I'll just say, after both of these movies, yes, Rebel, I think, is more memorable in ways, but without James Dean, East of Eden would be a completely different movie. So yeah, I would give it to him here as well. So moving on to Rebel Without a Cause. Description here: a rebellious young man with a troubled past comes to a new town, finding friends and enemies. This is directed by Nicholas Ray. It stars James Dean, Natalie Wood, Sal Mineo, Jim Backus, Corey Allen, and William Hopper. It was nominated for 3 Oscars for Supporting Actress for Natalie Wood, like you mentioned, Supporting Actor for Mineo, and Writing Motion Picture Story for Nicholas Ray. What are your thoughts on Rebel Without a Cause?
Rebel Without a Cause is one of those movies that I do think really defined an era. And it's not my favorite movie of the 1950s by any stretch of the imagination. But I think you can't really think of 50s cinema and what's to come in the culture without thinking of Rebel Without a Cause, and specifically James Dean's performance and just his connections to this movie. I cannot imagine learning that James Dean died in a car accident and then watching this, because this came out after the fact, and him having that chicken fight with Buzz driving to the edge of that cliff. When you think about the attitudes at the time, it's such an interesting movie to watch and to cover. And I think so much of the movie is around masculinity and how the perception of strength or weakness plays into that, and how I think James Dean's character views his father as being masculine or not, as being weak, is very indicative of the attitudes towards masculinity at the time. And I think that those, in the way now that politicians and people kind of think back on the 50s as being this great time, it really wasn't. And the ideas of home life back then and toughness and weakness and masculinity and femininity, how they come up, I think it is very timely, and it illustrates the 50s in a very smart way. And it also, I feel like, is still very relevant when you're watching it today. James Dean, his style of acting, this is the movie where, for me, it really rises above the rest of the actors, because I feel like he's doing something very different. He's doing something very physical. If you watch how his body moves scene to scene, there's really just nothing like it. And I think especially in his scenes alongside Natalie Wood, who is this very studio-trained, polished performer, it feels like you are watching people from two completely different times, which does throw me, I think, when I'm watching this. And that's why I made the comment about Natalie Wood's performance here, which maybe isn't fair, but it's, I think, it is just something I struggle with in watching her next to James Dean. But I feel like what's also interesting is that Sal Mineo, Natalie Wood, and James Dean all met untimely deaths very young, which is really sad when you think about this movie too and their characters here. Sal Mineo was murdered in the 70s. Natalie Wood, we know, of course, the mystery surrounding her death. So it makes it a tough watch, I think, when you're looking at it today. I think the themes, too, of what comes up at that trip to the planetarium, of life being short, of the world ending, of insignificance and a new day coming at the end, it feels darker when you think about the realities for these actors who are playing our three central characters.
There is nary a happy moment in this movie.
No.
It is bleak, and I love the score because it exacerbates that feeling, but there's something about the acting also playing into that and the scenes in general, but there's just this foreboding quality throughout the entire movie. There's one moment near the end where it seems like they finally found peace. And I didn't know that about Sal. That just, again, it makes it so heart-wrenching to think about this movie and, yeah, to think they had that car race, and then not even a year later, James Dean dies in a car crash. It's so hard. I mean, I don't think that plays into how I see the film. It is intriguing to see those differences in James Dean's acting. Like I said in the beginning, I love the opening title sequence. Immediately, you have a score that blows you away, that beautiful red font, and James Dean just coming up to the front of the screen, laying down in the road and tucking in that little stuffed animal to bed under a newspaper. And then he's found by the cops. He's very drunk and he does all of that so well. Again, it seems effortless, very quick exposition in the beginning with those three characters, like we mentioned, Jim, Judy, the Natalie Wood character, and Plato, who we'll later call him, that is Sal. And how they're all in families that are dysfunctional or not present. And that is really what's leading their lives. Again, Jim, I don't think, is a bad kid. It's just really all of them aren't getting the support they need or that they want from their parents. And then we get to meet Jim's parents through a conversation at the police station. Either his mom is just yelling at everybody, nothing is right, or the dad is just letting everything happen. He doesn't really have a say with his behavior. He sees his son is drunk and treating him like a king, and he's laughing about it. Like, he's not upset at all. And I would say it's harder to see those relationships in this movie than it was in East of Eden, because I think it's trying to be even more black and white in that distinction of why these kids are so-called troublemakers. When also Jim meets this gang, these bullies, he's brought into it because of his pride, and he doesn't like being called a chicken.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that he did wrong except stand up for himself. And it's funny what you say about the Natalie Wood character, because she is just so awful to everyone, especially to him, in the first half of this movie, that if this were the first movie I saw of her, I just wouldn't like her at all. It's like she's playing such a villain, but it's also, again, how she was brought up and her relationship with her dad, and maybe why that brought about her relationship with Buzz. So there are a lot of pieces that you can put together in terms of it being a great movie of the time and what relationships were like or what people were having trouble with at home. And the other thing about that is that these are the first movies that are doing that on screen and showing you this, which I think to us is difficult because we've seen this time and again. So I think you really have to put yourself in their shoes, especially if we're going to add melodrama into the mix and how that genre functions.
Yeah, it's very much of the time. You do have to put yourself, I think, back in 1955 to really think about why this movie had such an impact, especially, you know, on teenagers and thinking about the American family and whatever that means. Because here, like you said, it's incredibly dysfunctional. And I think with the Judy character, the Natalie Wood character, when we meet her at the beginning, it's because she's wandering the streets. She has this red lipstick on. And like you said, her relationship with her father is very strange. The fact that he's uncomfortable with her being a teenager and becoming a woman, that sends off all sorts of red flags for me, that this is not a guy to be trusted. And So for her, I think throughout the movie, she's really seeking male approval. You see this, I think, as she goes from being in love with Buzz to 20 seconds later, suddenly being into Jim and wanting to be with him. This is a character to me who, possibly because of issues at home or just what she's going through as a teenager, she needs this type of affection and attention from men. And if that's happening because of something that's going on at home with her father, that adds a really dark layer to everything too. And that's not, you know, it's not directly spelled out for us, but we could guess that something worse is happening at home behind closed doors. And the other piece of it with Jim, I think that's really interesting, is that he spends a lot of the movie wanting his dad to fight his mom, to, you know, embody this type of aggressive, direct masculinity, when that's not who he is. He is much more sensitive. And despite being critical of this behavior of his dad, this is how we see Jim evolve as a character. If you look at his relationship with Plato, specifically towards the end of the movie, he is this type of sensitive man, right? He's not this sort of aggressive alpha type that he wants his dad to be, because that's what he's absorbing in culture. So I think that that idea of masculinity is really important in the film. And I think James Dean plays with that very well. The interesting thing about their family too, though, is just how willing they are to just up and leave and not deal with any sort of consequence or drama that happens, because they've moved so much. And it's like every time something bad happens, like even after Jim comes home, after Buzz drives off the cliff, they want to move away. They don't want him to go to the police. He wants to go and explain himself and say what happened. He feels terribly about it. And his mom is like, well, what if no one else tells? Let's get out of here. And you get this idea that they've just never let him really deal with anything, or they've never dealt with anything. And they've also never let him establish a friend group or any sort of identity in a place. They just keep moving him around. And because of that, he has this reputation. He doesn't know anybody. And it's difficult for him to integrate into these groups, like at his high school, because he's always new. And he doesn't really know how to do that necessarily. And then, I mean, with the Plato character, what's interesting too is that this is based on a nonfiction book where this character is really the focus. The fact that he's there, Judy's there because she was wandering around the streets at night and they think she might be a sex worker. Jim is there because he was passed out drunk. Plato is there because he was shooting puppies. When I heard that, I thought there's no way that I can ever be on this character's side at all. He's shooting puppies. This is like a precursor to becoming a serial killer.
It's so true. And he doesn't answer for it. Why were you shooting puppies? No answer. Because I wanted to. What?
Scary.
In what world is that okay? And the fact that he knows that there's a gun in the house, it is really tragic, but it's thinking of it that way. Interesting how by the end of the movie, he's my favorite. Like, he's the one we're rooting for to turn the corner.
Yep, I agree. That is, I think, one of the successes really of the movie, is that you see these people who have these home lives that are very difficult to varying degrees, but he's the one who feels very innocent and troubled as you get to the end. And one of the things that I read about this movie that I just found fascinating was that Nicholas Ray told Salmoneo to look at James Dean like he was his driver's license, like he was kind of his freedom, his adulthood. And James Dean told Salmoneo to look at him the way that he looked at Natalie Wood, which gives the character this completely different understanding. And I think recontextualizes it as somewhat of a queer film, too, if you look at the way that he is looking at Jim.
Wow. I mean, a big part of the Plato character is, I mean, that's interesting behind the scenes, because in the film and near the end, he sees Jim and Judy as his parents, the ones that he's never had, or the ones that are actually there for him and support him. And again, those final moments with Plato and how he trusts in Jim and sticks with Judy, we see that he's found happiness, or a form of it, in this troubled world that he lives in. And yeah, I think that's the most troubling part, is reckoning with what happens, obviously, but that these characters have come together and found a family where they haven't elsewhere, and it's still not a life that is possible. This is one of those rushed endings where big climax and then happy ending in 30 seconds. And even though that happens, I don't think there's total belief in that. Jim goes, Mom, Dad, this is Judy, happily ever after. But there's still that dysfunction. So you question whether that's real or not. But that chosen family has been broken. And I think that's the most difficult part. Again, in a movie that you never feel happy, even when maybe you could, it takes it all away.
Yeah, I will say that I understand like your feeling of the ending feeling rushed, but I do enjoy it just for its thematic connections. I just always love stuff like this, but the fact that when they're at the planetarium, he's talking about the end of the world, the lecturer, and then later on near the ending, Plato asks Jim about the end of the world and if it's going to come at night, and Jim says it's going to come at dawn. And then at the very end of the movie, we have dawn. We have the sun coming up and it feels like it's this new day. And you saying that right about the chosen family being broken and Jim introducing Judy to his parents, what's interesting is that it feels like resolution or something new is coming. But from what Jim has said before, it's also the end of the world. It's this dark, twist on that, which I think is really, really cool. So I do like that. On that front, when James Dean, as Jim, yells, "I got the bullets," I instantly thought of La La Land and Ryan Gosling's character Seb quoting that to Mia, Emma Stone, and her pretending to have watched the movie, but clearly being unfamiliar with it, which then spawns our great planetarium scene and the date to Rebel Without a Cause in the movie. So let's talk about our love of La La Land with this.
We have to. That's all I thought about when I saw this movie. I said, I need to watch La La Land immediately. But it's so funny looking back at that scene because, again, I hadn't seen Rebel the many times I've seen La La Land. And it was an instant connection when you see those shots in this film. But when Mia is talking to Seb, she goes, "Oh my God, I got a call back for a TV show. It's Dangerous Minds meets The OC. It's like Rebel Without a Cause, sort of." And he's like, "I got the bullets." It's cute because, yeah, she doesn't understand what the movie is because she's never seen it. But then later in the movie, Ryan Gosling is wearing a red jacket, just like Jim's in the film, which is not only an iconic costume piece, but it's instrumental to his relationship with Plato. And that's another sad part. I mean, you can't go back to this movie without it, but the planetarium sequence, those beautiful shots in LA and inside the planetarium, I loved that scene early in the film when they're in there and the storm happens and it's the Big Bang and it sums the whole movie up. Yeah, it's life's greatest question. What does it all mean? The existence of man in the universe. Life is fleeting. And yeah, the end with, you know, or dawn, and maybe a little cheesy, but I get it. I get it. There's an ounce of hope that is left for the audience. But oh yeah, the La La Land connections, I absolutely adored. And I'm glad you felt the same way.
It really just made me want to watch La La Land again, too. And I thought about also how when Mia's auditioning for the part, she's wearing a red leather jacket, too. Mm. So that we have the red jacket there. And I love how Damien Chazelle replicates the shot of the car driving up the driveway to the Griffith Observatory. I think that's just beautiful, too. So, yes, pro Rebel Without a Cause and pro La La Land.
So how do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think it might be pretty similar. Like, three nominations feels about right. I think there is this gravity to the film. You can feel its bleakness, its seriousness, and how timely it is, too. And I think the Academy really does love to recognize films in that way. It's also interesting that James Dean wasn't nominated, and we can gather that he wasn't because they chose East of Eden instead for him. And I think that would pan out exactly the same way today. If you had an actor who was in a coming-of-age, dark film, and then this great epic, they would go with the epic. So I think it would pan out pretty similarly. What do you think?
I think that just re-emphasizes how dumb I think that rule is, because his performances are so different. And I would say that he deserves a nomination for both.
Yeah.
You're going to make the studio delay the film a year, and that just gets into the business side of it, which ruins the art of it all. And I think similarly, though, acting-wise, there could be some texts. Again, I like the cinematography. It's not only for the CinemaScope, but we have the DP, Ernest Haller, here. He worked on Betty Davis films, Mildred Pierce. He shot Gone with the Wind. Sometimes today we see, you know, if you win for a film or you have multiple films like that in your filmography, it could be sort of an easier nomination for you. So I maybe would have liked to have seen some of those here. I also loved the composer, Leonard Rosenman, his score. Again, I mentioned that with the opening, but he scored both of these films and he won for Barry Lyndon and Bound for Glory. Mm. So he's been around. Yeah, I think you still have nominations for, like, Natalie Wood, like you mentioned, a studio veteran. I think similarly. I think maybe a little bit better, but if we're comparing these two, I definitely think there would still be more for East of Eden.
Yeah, I agree. And I love the point about the score. I think the score is fantastic and would definitely be recognized today. Mm-hmm. But if you could give this movie one Oscar, What would it be? And would it be best actor for James Dean? You can cheat the rules here if you want to just give him a double best actor win for 1955.
I just said I'd give him two nominations, and I don't think I'm giving him the Oscar. I think this is so hard. I mean, Nicholas Ray did write and direct this film, so I think there's a lot of cohesion that happens with the acting and the setups in the film and how that works out. I think how this movie inspired Grease, I couldn't not think about that movie also, and a bit of West Side Story. There's Natalie Wood again. But I think I'm going to give it to Sal Mineo because of his performance of Plato. It's the central idea of the film really is around his character and how he's battling with his existence. I think Jim also is on a very deep level, and it's why they befriend each other so early on. They both are also great physical actors, but I think at the end of the day, I'm, yes, left thinking of James Dean screaming, "You're tearing me apart," but there's also Plato on the other hand, and you feel his innocence and how his disjointed childhood has really affected him and taken a real life away from him. And I think in the long run, I'll end up thinking of him equally as James Dean, which I think says enough because it's James Dean. So I'll give it to him just to switch it up. What would your Oscar be for?
I like that answer. Also wild that he was only 17 when he was nominated for playing Plato. Yeah. I would go with James Dean, though. I think this is such an iconic character interpretation and performance that I have to give it to him. I think that there's a reason why so many actors, I think, reference this performance as one of the greatest and this character also. And you made a comparison earlier to Marlon Brando, and they had plans to make this actually earlier in the 40s with Marlon Brando. And I think I can see that, but I really just can't see it as much as the version that we got in the 50s with James Dean. So I'm going to give him my Oscar again. I really do think he's one of our greatest movie stars and singular screen talents.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm glad we covered both of these movies. I will let you know when I watch Giant. He still also holds the record for the first to receive a posthumous Academy Award nomination and the only one to have two posthumous nominations in his career. So he is one of our great actors. He's number 18 on AFI's 100 Years, 100 Stars list. And he's one that will absolutely endure the test of time.
I'm so glad that we covered him today. Make sure you go watch East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we will be kicking off a new series for this season. We will be doing a frequent collaborator series. So we'll spend an episode going through a great collaboration in cinema. And our first one will be Akira Kurosawa and Toshirô Mifune. Their collaborations, specifically watching Rashomon and High and Low. So Spike Lee has a new film, Highest to Lowest, which is a remake of High and Low, coming to Cannes this year, just in a few weeks. So we thought it would be a good idea to cover High and Low too, but I can't wait to talk about these two. I think definitely one of cinema's strongest collaborations. And we haven't talked about Kurosawa yet on the pod, so I'm very, very excited to watch these and to discuss.
I am ecstatic that we're finally talking about him. In the past few years, he's increasingly and easily become one of my favorite directors. He has so many other films, but these are two of my favorites. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about these. Thank you everyone for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, Blue Sky, Twitter, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. And we have bonus content, including a little segment on next week's episode, dealing with Spike Lee and that adaptation, like you mentioned, at patreon.com/OscarWilde.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.